This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. This evening's candles represent the third night of Hanukkah, and we're less than 2 weeks from Christmas. And that means if you're shopping for gifts, you might well be into full panic mode.
Which is why we have an all-gift theme show for you today. Some are physical, some experiential, and some less tangible. We'll start with a visit from writer and games aficionado James Lowder, who joins us every year at this time. James, it is so great to see you.
Oh, great to see you too.
You know what time of year it is.
It is games to gift time.
It is games to gift time. And this is, how many years have you been doing this for
us? This is the eighth, I believe.
Yeah. And you were saying just before we turned on the microphones that some of the game stores still have old lists that people are referring to.
Yes. And the Lake Effect website has several of the lists from past shows up, and many of the games, or actually most of the games on those lists, are still available and still really good suggestions.
Cool, but we have new things
to
talk about this year. But let's talk about trends first. We always like to start with what's been happening since we talked last a year ago. Tabletop games.
So tabletop games, and that's board games, card games, role-playing games, miniatures games, are being created in kind of record numbers now, and record numbers of really great games as well. And partly that's driven by Kickstarter. Partly it's driven by people having the technology in their own houses to be able to do design at a pretty high level and then seek out publishers to work with for that. It's a good thing and a bad thing. The good part is you've got many, many, many great games to choose from. The bad thing is stores are having a hard time, even specialty game stores, keeping up with all of the new games. And games have been pushing into hobby games, and tabletop games have been pushing into the mass market in places like the big box stores and Barnes & Noble and places like that. But we're actually seeing, with the shaky state of brick-and-mortar retail, a lot of those stores are pushing their games back into to the publishers. So we'll have to see what impact that has long-term on game publishing health.
Well, obviously, there's some sort of demand. People are buying them.
Yes. But the question is, with Kickstarters and things like that, you can reach out to a small market and just fund your game with a few hundred people, and that's enough. But once you get a game out into the mass market, Target has to sell a lot more copies than a Kickstarter does in order for that game to be successful for the publisher.
Well, what other trends have you seen? Are there changes in online versus tabletop games?
Well, one of the interesting things this year that happened was PAX, the computer game convention, had their first PAX Unplugged, which was dedicated to tabletop. So it's going backwards. There's all of these people who originally got into computer games going from Dungeons and Dragons and things like that in the 70s. Now there's a whole generation who got into gaming through electronic gaming, and now they're looking for other things to do, sitting across the table from people. So they're looking at role-playing games and board games beyond Catan and some of the more well-known tabletop hobby games.
Who says time can't go backwards?
Oh, right? Exactly.
At least in the game world and the game universe, it can. What about ways of playing? Has that changed at all in the last year?
Well, a couple of years ago, the trend was toward the giant box games that were $100 and took 2 to 3 hours to play, and we've gone in a different direction this year, especially with many of the games for a lower price point and playing in a half an hour or under.
It sounds like people want to get things done faster.
Sure, people have limited time, and you can't sit down and set up a board game that's going to take you 5 hours to play, you know, every week.
I was going to say, not unless you're 12 and you have your parents' basement.
Yes.
Well, and that's the thing is, and we've talked about this before too, is that these kinds of games appeal to all audiences. I mean, I think there's still a stereotype out there that this is like a bunch of 12-year-old boys sitting down and playing Dungeons & Dragons or something like that. I mean, there are those people, but there are also people like you and me sitting around a kitchen table.
Sure. Well, at one point I was that teenage boy playing D&D, though we had girls in all our groups. The thing that's amazing is how much this has become mainstream culture. So everybody's watching the Marvel movies and everybody's familiar with Lord of the Rings, so they understand the tropes and they understand the storytelling. And playing Dungeons and Dragons where you're a hero on a quest like Frodo goes on is not a mystery now to a lot of people. It's not something that's inaccessible. They understand Game of Thrones and Walking Dead. So the games appeal to them, too.
So before we get into some of your best ofs for this past year, are we seeing changes in previous games that we've talked about?
Well, one of the things that is happening is sort of the sequelitis that you see in Hollywood. So a lot of games that are successful are getting expansions. A lot of games are getting new additions. So Munchkin, which is all about doing expansions and new versions, did a Rick and Morty set this year. They also have Munchkin Shakespeare. So
I'd like that one.
Which is great. It's a fun game. Codenames, which we've mentioned in the past, has a really great two-player option called Duet. But they've also got a Marvel-themed version of the game and a Disney-themed version of the game, which, again, speaks to that growing popularity to a wider audience.
You also have on here Catan Game of Thrones.
Yes, they did a Game of Thrones version of Catan. They also did a chocolate version of Catan where it comes with pieces of chocolate. When you win, you get to eat them. So it's very nice Belgian chocolate.
Oh, I was going to say, I would play just for the chocolate.
Which is, right. And that, it's a simplified version of the Catan rules. So if you have somebody who is a little reluctant to try a hobby game, but they are a sucker for chocolate, this is a great way to do it.
Say entice them with chocolate.
Here you go.
Yeah. All right. So we have a list of games that you recommend this year. Let's start with the family games.
A lot of really great family games this year, and this is something we talked a little bit about last year. The design that's going on, the increased quality of design that's going on in hobby games is filtering now down to family games and kids games in ways that create a variety of material that you wouldn't have found on the shelves 10 or 20 years ago. And one of the ones that's top of that list is King Domino from Blue Orange. And it's a game for 2 to 4 players, 8 and up, where you are a monarch trying to expand your kingdom, and you're using these domino tiles they have. It plays in some ways very much like dominoes, but you are connecting up the dominoes in a 5x5 grid, and then scoring based on the types of groupings that you can get for sea tiles or forest tiles. So you want to make them bigger areas to score more points at the end of the game. And there's a really clever mechanic on how you draw the dominoes. You take them out depending on the number of players, say 3 at a time, but they're ordered, and each time a person picks, it's going to impact what their draw order is the next time they pick.
So not everybody gets the same advantage.
Correct, and yeah. It changes with every turn. So, and you're building on a 5x5 grid, and then once you run out of the dominoes, everybody scores. It's a really fast game. It plays in about 20 to 25 minutes and retails for about $20.
So what else have you got between the family and kids games that you recommend?
Con of Cons is another one from Chaosium that's great. You are cow raiders in the fantasy world of Glorantha, which if you're a dedicated hobbyist is a familiar name. Glorantha has been around since the 70s. Greg Stafford created it, and it's been a fantasy setting used for things like the venerable RuneQuest role-playing game. You don't need to know any of that to play Con of Cons. It just picks up that material. So if you're a hobbyist, it's just extra chrome on it that is cool. The mechanic is you are one of a number of fantasy tribes, and you are raiding different areas in this sort of Bronze Age kingdom where you are collecting up cows, and it's got a push-your-luck mechanic. You're trying to build the biggest herd and then corral them. But if you wait too long, somebody else can come along and raid them, or there can be a stampede, or enemy magic can scatter your cows or take your cows away before you actually score them.
Nothing worse than enemy magic.
That's correct.
Against your cow herd.
That's right. When you're just trying to steal cows and somebody throws a spell.
Throws a spell on it. And so, obviously, that sounds like it's fun for all ages. Is that 8 and up also?
It's 9 and up.
9 and up,
but
okay.
it plays for younger kids as well with some guidance. 2 to 5, it's a $25 game. Again, plays in under half an hour. It's got enough strategy that it's fun for a whole range in the family.
You also have a couple of specifically kids' games mentioned, the Ghost Fighting Treasure Hunters.
Yes, which is kind of an amazing amazing title. It's an adaptation of a German game with a long and confusing title, which I won't butcher in German. That was around in 2014 and won European Game Design Awards. You're kids working together in a haunted mansion to recover gems, and you're contesting with the ghosts. And the ghosts show up depending on what you roll, and you can fight the ghosts as well. It's a cooperative game. If you get more than three ghosts in a room, a haunting shows up, and they're tougher to beat, and you need two players working together to defeat the hauntings. And if all six hauntings appear on the board, the game is over and the players lose. But it's a fun game, and it's got a really nice level of strategy that still plays for younger kids, and it will still be entertaining. Even crossover parents aren't going to be pulling their hair out if they're asked to play this one with the kids as well.
And you also have Rhino Hero.
Rhino Hero's Super Battle is the new version. Rhino Hero came out a few years ago, and it's a stacking game, a dexterity game, sort of like Jenga, except you're using cardboard pieces to build a tower. And in this version, it's Rhino Hero and his superhero friends are trying to get to the top of the structure as it's being built. And of course, what superheroes do when they run into each other is fight. So if you have superheroes end up on the same floor in a turn, the superheroes fight, and that just moves the players down or up. It's not a big conflict thing, but your goal is to create the tower and be at the top when it falls, unless you're the person who caused it to fall. If you're at the top when the tower falls, you win. If you're at the top and you cause the tower to fall, you lose and everybody else wins.
So be careful.
So be careful. Yes,
that.
And
yeah.
It's a dexterity game, and it's actually really clever. It combines with the original Rhino Hero, so you can expand the game to five players from that, and it's good for kids five and up. 2 to 4 players normally, but if you combine it with, if you've got the old version of Rhino Hero, you can combine it for 5 players.
You have a couple of role-playing games, of course. Pick the one you like the best.
Boy, that's a tough question. The great thing about role-playing games right now is the two of the venerable engines, Dungeons & Dragons and Call of Cthulhu, which I mentioned last time, have come up with new great additions, and that's bringing a lot of people back into the hobby. A lot of those computer game people are trying those games. And once they play them, they discover, gee, I really like sitting around a table and playing with people in person rather than maybe over headphones. And so there's a lot of innovation going on, expanding the types of games that are available. Dungeons & Dragons, the classic, is a fight the monsters, kill the monsters, take their stuff kind of combat game. The two that I mentioned this year, Blue Rose and Pugmire, are very much the opposite. They are hopeful games built upon cooperation and often overtly nonviolence, finding other ways in which to solve the problems.
Diplomacy.
And Blue Rose is built around a fantasy kingdom, much more in keeping with romantic fantasy, and romantic there being things like Mercedes Lackey and stories that are based upon relationships and a wide range of story types rather than just the quest fantasy or the conquest fantasy. It openly encourages diversity in the types of characters that you draw up. So orientation and physical ability and things like that are all baked into the system. You know, role-playing is about trying different perspectives. So if you want to try a different perspective for a character, Blue Rose is a fine game to play with that. Gorgeous art, really a great thing. Pugmire is easy to describe in a short amount of time. It's post-apocalyptic, but it's not grim. Dogs have succeeded humankind in the world, and they are looking for ways in which to be heroic and live up to the code of man and decide how to be a good dog.
Before we get to your top pick of the year, you've got a couple of hobby games listed here. For those who might not remember, describe the difference between, say, a hobby game and a family game or a role-playing.
Family games are aimed at a more general audience. They don't require a lot of time investment. They're one-offs more frequently. You're playing them for one night, and then you can put it away and you start it again the next time, and it's fun, and it's the same game, more or less. Hobby games invite longer-term commitment to the game. They often have and role-playing games are a typical example of a hobby game because they require a lot of study of the texts. You play over time, and your character develops, and it's built around campaigns. It's not built necessarily around one-offs. There are exceptions, but that's the general rule. Hobby game board games, chess is a hobby game. Go is a hobby game. You can play them over and over again, but every time you play it, you develop strategies. You get better as a player. It's inviting deeper play.
So you have three that you've liked for this year.
Onitama is the first one, and this is kind of a classic hobby game. It was actually first published in 2014 by a small press in Japan and is just making it over here. It's a two-player game played on a 5x5 grid where you have a master and four disciples. And it's a card movement game where you get five of the 16 cards. There are 16 possible movement cards in the game. And you draw five of them, and those are the five you're going to use during the game. And your goal is to either capture the other player's master or to put your master in the pagoda, which is the center square of the back row in the grid. And you can only use the moves on the cards. But every time you use a move, you pass it along, and your opponent will get to use that move then eventually next. So it's a perfect knowledge game. You know everything that everyone can do at any point in the game. It's a really fast game, plays in 5 to 10 minutes a lot of times, but it's got an incredibly deep strategy to it, and it changes every time because the five cards out of the 16 possible move configurations changes every time. So if you like Go and you like those abstract strategy games, this is a gem.
So what about Fuse?
Fuse is sort of the opposite. It's Tama is a kind of a contemplative game. Fuse is a crazy game where you are a bomb defusal team. There have been 20 or more bombs planted on your ship, and you've got to defuse them in 10 minutes. It is a real-time cooperative game. You only have 10 minutes, and this goes back to what I was saying about that shorter playing time, too. You only have 10 minutes to do it, and each one of the bombs requires you to roll certain combinations on the dice from all the players on the table and combine them to eliminate that bomb card. And the cards are leveled so you can have harder or easier bombs to defuse. And you can scale the game so that you can actually include more bombs if you really want a hard challenge, which is one of the reasons that this is a hobby game. That scalability means that you can make this game as challenging as your group needs it to be.
So how many people are playing that one typically?
Typically, that's 1 to 5. There are solo scenarios for it, too, and it's designed by Madison designer Kane Klinko, who also has a dexterity game out this year, Flip Ships, which is essentially a version of the old computer game Space Invaders, where you are physically flipping your ships to attack the enemy ships as they come down to invade Earth.
Well, one more in the hobby game that you listed, Tomb of Annihilation.
Dungeons & Dragons Tomb of Annihilation is it harkens back to some of the games we've talked about in past shows. It's the honking great box of stuff that you will play for a very long time. It's
set up your basement for this one.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's built around the Dungeons & Dragons board game lines in the last few years have done these massive board games every year, tied around different themes for the company's intellectual property. So they had a Drist, the Dark Elf Drow Fighter. They had a Drist board game, and they had other games like that. This one, Tomb of Annihilation, takes you to the jungle setting in the Forgotten Realms fantasy campaign, which is rife with zombies and dinosaurs and lost temples and all sorts of fun things like that. And it's a cooperative game, and it plays like a board game version of Dungeons & Dragons. You can play these as one-off scenarios. You can play them as a very long campaign where actually the game scales up as you play, so you get better treasures and tougher monsters the more you go on.
Ooh. I just love zombies and dinosaurs together.
And it is. And I have to say, Tomb is got a special place in my heart because I worked on the Forgotten Realms at one point, and 25 years ago or so, I wrote a novel, And they actually picked up some of the monsters and the characters that I created for this game. So you get little plastic pieces of some of the guys I created. I don't get a royalty. This isn't a financial interest thing. It's just that's one of the cool things about working in a shared world, like the Star Wars universe or the Marvel universe. Occasionally you create things and then 25 years later is, that bad guy I created is on the box of a board game.
Gotta love that.
Which is pretty cool.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. All right, so we have come to your top pick for 2017. What is this game and why did you choose it?
The top game I picked this year is Photosynthesis, again from Blue Orange. And it's kind of a remarkable game. It's a great idea for a game. It's certainly unique. You look at a board game called Photosynthesis and you sort of go, I wonder what that is. And it is sort of what it promises. You are growing trees in a board area that has kind of a circular board area that has spots with point values on them. The higher the point value, the closer you go into the middle, and everybody starts growing their trees on the edge. Depending on how much sunlight you gather based on the trees you plant, that's how many action points you have. So you are trying to grow your trees. You start off with seeds, and then they grow to level one trees and level two trees and level three trees. But the cool part is depending on where you place those trees, they cast shade on the trees around them. And for three turns, the sun moves around the board. So you are looking at actually trying to figure out where the shadows are going to be cast on the four positions of the sun as it moves around the board. And take into account how you can move your trees and grow them closer to the center of the board where you can claim the most points. So once you grow your tree up through three stages, on the fourth stage you can let it die and pass back into the soil, at which point you collect the points for that square. It's a very nice mix of abstract strategy game, but it's also a clever use of the theme because you can look at that board and see, this tree is taller than the tree next to it, so it's going to not be affected by shade. Or, this person just put up a three-point tree next to my one-point trees. Now I'm really going to be burned when the sun comes around and I get no sun points from which I will be able to do my actions.
Again, good for all ages pretty much?
Yes, it's 10 and up. Pretty much. It's got a little more strategy to it than some of the other games we've been talking about, but 10 is still a pretty decent threshold for a family game, and it is simple enough that people are going to be able to figure out how to play it quickly, but the strategy is very complex, and you'll find a lot of replay value in the game.
Well, James Lauder, as always, a huge list of games to try for this year. I want to thank you for coming in. I hope you have a very Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Oh, you too. Happy holidays.
James Lauder has worked in fiction and hobby game publishing for more than two decades. He is the editor of the award-winning anthologies Hobby Games, The 100 Best, and Family Games. And he joins us every year around this time to share his games to gift list. You'll find it all in one place at WUWM.com.